This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In what may be the most extensively telegraphed announcement in its history, the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee of the Federal Reserve Board is expected to announce a 0.25% interest rate hike in about 9 minutes at 2:15 Eastern Time. The rate is currently at a 46-year low of 1%. The predicted uptick will be the first in 4 years. We're going to talk about the economic context of this decision and what it may mean for the economy as a whole, and more particularly for those of us who will want to borrow money for cars or homes or credit cards. Later in the program, we'll explore an oft-cited economic indicator, the Index of Consumer Confidence, to see how it works and why it's up. If you have questions about the Fed's decision today, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. We'd also welcome questions about consumer confidence, how it's measured, what it means, how it reflects economic reality where you live. Again, 800-989-8255 or TOTN at NPR.org. But first, the Fed. We go to New York, and Mike Santoli, a senior editor at Barron's Magazine. And Mike, thanks for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
So how will you and the rest of the world find out what the Fed says?
Well, it'll be released across all the news wires, on the Fed's website, on television, everywhere you might be able to look, at about 2:15. The decision certainly is already made at this point, and it seems as if it's, as you alluded to earlier, a little more of a kind of a formality than it often is, simply because there's almost universal expectation of exactly what will be done, meaning a 0.25% increase in the short-term overnight borrowing rate, which is what the Fed directly controls. Some of the discrepancies in terms of forecasts involve the language that the committee might use to characterize its position, which, of course, is always very closely scrutinized as well.
Yeah, there's a short statement that generally accompanies the announcement of whatever the FOMC decided to do.
Right, exactly.
And again, that's published on the website?
It should be published on the website, yes, shortly after it is made public at 2:15, yes.
So there's no grand announcement, there's no news conference, there's no great event that everybody's looking at computer screens.
No,
basically.
Unfortunately, no. It's actually it's been a 2-day meeting, so all the policymakers have been in a kind of locked in a room for 2 days. And interestingly, the way the news kind of mechanically gets out is there's a press room that is locked and there is no computer access, and there's this sort of embargoed release of the statement that reporters can see for a period of time and then prepare their reports, and then at exactly 2:15 is when they're permitted to, you know, use a phone or something and call in the story. So it really is, it's not exactly the splashiest release, but it's pretty functional.
Well, Mike, hang on with us. We're going to come back to you in just a few minutes and check in on what the Fed actually says and what it actually does. Mike Santoli, a senior editor at Barron's Magazine. Joining us now from his office in Boston is Bill Cheney, chief economist for MFC Global Investment Management, and thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Now, the reason so much attention is being paid to today's Fed decision is that they haven't raised rates in the past 4 years. Isn't there some nervousness whenever the Fed starts the first uptick in a long time?
You would think there would be some nervousness after this long period. But as Mike said, this is so well expected. It's been so clearly telegraphed that really it's more of a symbolic moment than anything else at this point. It's more, finally the Fed is certifying that the economy is back on its feet, it's off life support, and they can start going back to what they would regard as more normal interest rates.
So for, I guess, the last change in the Federal Reserve interest rate was about a year ago.
That's correct. And the last change was another cut in the rate down to this near record low of 1%. And that had implications for the economy beyond just short-term interest rates. I mean, it ripples through the financial markets. It affects people's expectations. It affects long-term interest rates, the costs of mortgages, and so on. And finally, now we will be getting away from this period of what has seemed like wonderfully cheap money to, as I say, a more normal environment where, in a sense, the economy has to stand on its own feet without getting this extra shot of adrenaline from the Federal Reserve.
And that was to combat the effects of the recession, no?
That was exactly to combat the lingering effects of the recession. The recession took place back in 2001, and according to the statisticians, was over in a fairly short period of time. I mean, it was over by the end of the year, 2001. And then we suffered through a long, long period of sort of on-and-off recovery, a little growth, a little faltering. It was called the jobless recovery for a while, but even that was kind of a euphemism, given that, in fact, it wasn't just jobless. We kept on losing jobs.
Hemorrhaging in some places.
That's correct. I mean, the manufacturing sector just was heading on down. Many parts of the economy were losing jobs right and left. And finally, this year, things started to look up again. And in fact, they started to look up very slowly at the beginning of the year, and then at an accelerated pace, we started seeing a lot more job creation, some hints of price increases, so a lot more talk of potential inflation. And in a sense, rather suddenly, we're back to the situation where the Fed has to worry about inflation rather than deflation, has to worry about the economy moving too fast rather than too slow. And they're sitting here with interest rates at a record low level, wanting to get them up quite a lot higher quite quickly. They've promised to do it slowly, but it remains to be seen how slow is slow.
And what we're going to be looking for in the accompanying statement after today's decision is something like the word measured. Is that right?
In the last statement, they used the phrase a measured pace. It's funny analyzing this. It's sort of like the Oracle of Delphi or analyzing the photographs of the Kremlin back in the 1960s and 70s. Here we are looking at a set of words which, on the face of it, mean almost the same thing from one statement to another. One time they'll say they're going to keep rates low for a considerable period of time. Another time they'll say they can be patient. Last time they said they're going to have to raise rates sometime, but they'll do it at a measured pace. But all of these things leave them pretty much free to respond to whatever really happens. If the economy heats up too much for their liking, they could decide that a measured pace is a lot faster than we think it is today.
Well, we've got a minute or two before the announcement comes out. Let's take a call from Jeff, who's on the line with us from St. Louis.
Hi. My question was, I've heard recently that European banks have been talking about raising rates, and I was wondering if that might have been a catalyst to us all of a sudden wanting to change them, kind of stay on par with them and so forth.
Did you get a chance to hear that, Bill Cheney?
Yes, I did. Good question, and people certainly do pay a lot of attention to the relative interest rates in different countries, but I don't think the Federal Reserve really does view that as determining its policy. We're the 100-pound gorilla. We don't really have to care about other people's interest rates. They have to worry about ours. And yes, the Bank of England's been raising rates, but that's just a symptom of the same things going on there.
Jeff, thanks very much for the call. In fact, you mentioned the Bank of England has been raising rates. There's also people concerned about the state of the euro, and this could this rate hike, if it comes through, might adjust that as well.
That's correct. Changes in interest rates in the U.S. relative to overseas certainly have an impact on the exchange rate, and any increases in U.S. rates, if they're not matched by the European Central Bank, will tend to strengthen the U.S. dollar.
Well, all right. It's just about the tick of 2:15 Eastern Time. In fact, that's now. So let's go back to Mike Santoli, senior editor at Barron's Magazine in New York. And I guess can we have a drum roll, please, Mike?
Well, it looks like we might have to continue to have a drum roll, at least by way of my my real-time news wires. I have not yet seen the headlines come out, so we're sort of still waiting for this all to be processed at the moment. We okay. do assume that the committee tends to be fairly prompt, so we imagine it would be fairly soon.
Well, Mr. Greenspan, remind us, he's now a lame duck, isn't he, at the head of the Federal Reserve Board?
In a sense, a lame duck, yes. Of course, he was just sort of renominated for another term, which is widely assumed that he will get confirmed for that term, and therefore this will be his last term as chairman, which was always relatively expected. I don't think anybody was going to stand up and challenge that possibility. And, you know, whether that matters or not is obviously an issue of wide dispute. So some folks just assume that because the Fed chairman is nominated by the president, that there's some kind of, you know, political sense of debt, or he's beholden somehow to a particular political view. And it's hard to necessarily pinpoint that or to say whether that matters very much. But what the market is pleased with is that his stewardship is going to be around for a little bit longer. I do think that, that the market was not interested in having somebody else necessarily kind of step in there, because if nothing else, the market seems to believe it knows how Greenspan thinks, and Greenspan manages to communicate his views to the market, even though he's sort of widely mocked for being kind of a tortured communicator. In fact, the market tends to get a pretty good idea of what he intends to do, much more so than it used to, in fact.
We're still awaiting the announcement by the Federal Reserve Board of its decision on interest rates. If you have questions about how that anticipated hike may affect the economy or you, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And a reminder, later in the program, we're going to be talking about that oft-cited economic indicator, the Index of Consumer Confidence. If you have questions about how that index is gathered, what it means, and how it's used, and whether it reflects reality, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Also email totn@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Fred. Hi, Fred.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
My question is basically, does the government need to introduce some inflation at this point to help pay off the debt that we've racked up in the last number of years?
Bill Cheney?
Oh, a tricky question. In the long run, it clearly would reduce the real value of the government's debt to permit a lot of inflation. But I don't believe that the Federal Reserve actually has any interest in doing that whatsoever. First of all, they are the Federal Reserve and they're not the Treasury. They're not the same institution. And secondly, the self-respect that the Federal Reserve Board gets is from being respected central bankers who control inflation. It's not in their personal interest to let that happen. I don't think that's in any way an objective or a consideration in Fed policy.
Fred, thank you. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Fred. I'm sorry.
Would there be other aspects of the government that would, through another way, encourage increasing inflation somewhat to help ease that burden?
I think at this point in time, I don't think there are too many parts of the government where people would welcome a whole lot of inflation. I think looking ahead, you can certainly imagine an environment in which there's just too many pressures on the government from the retirement of the baby boom, the problems of Medicare and Social Security, and they would be very happy to let inflation rip a bit. Maybe they wouldn't actually be looking for the inflation, but they would certainly prefer the kinds of policies that would permit it.
We did just see the rate increase, by the way, folks.
And it goes up how much, Mike Sento?
0.25 to 1.25%, as expected. And it does appear that the word measured is also in the statement. So at this point, it looks like things went pretty much precisely according to plan. The Fed also said, as it did, I believe, the last time, that the balance of risks to the economy are basically equal between rising inflation and faltering growth. So basically, they've not necessarily said that they're going to be fighting one more than another. So that's all in all, right across the board, I believe, exactly as the market expected here.
And Bill Cheney, if this is the first uptick, everybody writes that we can expect it to go up in the next year or so to about 4%, right?
I think the question of whether it goes up to 4%, 3%, 3.5%, 4.5% is kind of academic, depends on what happens in the meantime, but basically that's it. The Fed is looking to get up to what they consider a neutral level of interest rates. We're not quite sure what neutral is, but it's somewhere in that zone.
Well, we're delighted the Fed managed to get its decision off in time before the break we have to take right now. We're going to be back with more of your calls for Mike Santoli and Bill Cheney about the meaning of today's 0.25% hike in federal interest rates. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Just a few minutes ago, the Federal Reserve announced a 0.25% hike in interest rates. If you have questions about the Fed's decision, give us a call, 800-989-8255. And in a few minutes, we'll find out how the Index of Consumer Confidence works and why it's up this month. If you have questions about that, how consumer confidence is measured, if it reflects the economic realities where you live, you can also call now, 800-989-8255. Or email us, TOTN at NPR.org. With us are Mike Santoli, a senior editor at Barron's Magazine, and Bill Cheney, chief economist for MFC Global Investment Management. He's in Boston. And Mike, I just wanted to get back to sort of the event or non-event of this announcement. When that message flashed across your screen, my screen, televisions all over the world, what, if anything, did people do?
The only people that did much of anything, it seems to me, is that there was a little bit of buying of stocks, as far as I can tell. I mean, just very marginal increase in stock prices. I think because of the removal of whatever little bit of uncertainty might have been hanging out there, largely regarding the language that the Fed was going to use. I mean, essentially, the Fed has told the markets that it had it right coming into this, and basically everybody's on the same page. So nothing else much happened. I mean, the functional thing here is this is the rate that governs, you know, overnight lending between banks. It's not something that in that sense touches anyone's daily lives. But you will very soon see regular banks coming out most likely and raising their prime rate for lending. So that is something that obviously trickles out through the economy over time.
Well, let's get some listeners' questions in. Heather joins us from Medford, Massachusetts.
Hi, I was wondering what effect this increase will have on housing prices and actually the rental market, too.
Bill Cheney.
Well, this rate increase probably will have no discernible effect on any of those things for the reason that, in effect, it's already had its impact. Because the Fed did exactly what was expected, long-term interest rates had already built that into their current level. And that means that mortgage rates, the things that tend to affect most people's lives the most, had already embodied this expected increase, and indeed a couple more down the road in the rest of this year. If you think back a few months ago, back in the early part of the spring, we had a low point in mortgage rates. People had another opportunity to refinance. Things looked a little shaky on the economic side. Since then, the expectations shifted to the assumption that the Fed was going to raise rates a series of times, probably adding up to about a full percentage point, and long-term rates went up about that amount. So mortgage rates have already done a lot of the Fed's dirty work in terms of restraining the housing market, making it more expensive to get mortgages, and cooling things off just a little bit.
And refinancing of mortgages, as I understand it, has slowed considerably.
Refinancing of mortgages has almost dropped off the map. The housing sector, in terms of new purchases and new construction, has kept on going gangbusters because the overall level of mortgage rates, even though it's gone up a bit, is still, in a historical context, pretty attractive. And setting that aside, the fact that a lot of people are getting jobs or feeling more secure in their jobs, actually, the situation is not bad. But clearly, the higher mortgage rates go, the longer this process of interest rate hikes keeps on, the more the housing market is going to be pulled back.
Thanks for the question, Heather.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Here's our systems are almost as good as yours, Mike Santoli. Here's the question. Here's the statement released by the Federal Reserve as it announced the increase. The committee perceives the upside and downside risks to the attainment of both sustainable growth and price stability for the next few quarters are roughly equal, with underlying inflation still expected to be relatively low. The committee believes that policy accommodation can be removed at a pace that is likely to be measured. Nonetheless, the committee will respond to changes in economic prospects as needed to fulfill its obligation to maintain price stability. Rough translation, Mike?
Well, effectively what they're saying is what the market cares about and what most folks should care about is the Fed is not raising any alarms about recent increases in inflation. It says, yes, we're aware that some of the inflation measures have kind of ticked higher recently, but it did earlier in its statement said that it believes a large part of that is due to transitory or temporary effects, which largely would probably be gasoline and other energy prices. So effectively, the Fed is saying we're going to take, knowing what we know now, we're going to take a relatively slow course of raising short-term interest rates. We don't feel there's need to be alarmed. We don't feel that we're too late here to try and choke off inflation. So basically, it says that you know the economy is on a what they believe is a sustainable growth path, and they will remain kind of on alert for any signs that inflation picks up. But right now, it's not something to worry too much about.
Email question from Daryl Lance in Rochester, New York. Why aren't interest rates determined by market forces since money is, in a sense, a commodity? If demand is high, rates should go up and vice versa. Why is so much attention given to the Fed's rate? Bill Cheney?
Well, the Fed produces money. The Fed is one of those rare institutions in the world among central banks. The Fed is an institution whose obligations are, in fact, money. They can pump out money into the economy to their heart's content as they deem necessary, and thereby demand and supply do indeed determine the price of money, but they control the supply. So if they want to drive the price down, the interest rate, they just have to pump out more money.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Ryan from East Lyme, Connecticut.
How you doing?
Okay.
All right. I just have a question for you. I'm a college student who's starting to look into borrow money and make some investments. And I was just wondering, in general, what do these interest rate changes mean for me? Over the years, I've seen them go up and down and whatnot, but I'm not really sure what it's doing to me and what I should look for.
Yeah, we have a similar question from Katie in Rochester, New York, on email. I'm a 24-year-old financial dummy. I rent an apartment, own a car with no payments, pay monthly student loans, $13,000 left, and have about $17,000 in basic credit union savings account. I have no idea like how these big event affects someone like me. Any idea? Mike, do you want to take a shot at that?
Sure. Well, in that particular situation, it sounds like it doesn't have a tremendous effect at all directly on her. I mean, effectively, if you have a mortgage where the rate is locked in, this change doesn't mean anything at all. What it really does affect potentially is any kind of loans or any debt that somebody might have that is floating rate. That does include lots of credit card debt, for example, perhaps some home equity loans and things where the rate is determined based on the prime rate. Now, in general, it doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot. I think really the message to take from it is more the context of it all, which is that, you know, short-term rates have been at a, you know, 45 or 46-year low for a very long time. The Fed is characterizing this as bringing these rates back up to a more neutral level and just sort of taking its foot off the gas pedal to try to speed the economy, but not yet putting it on the brake to really try and slow it down. So in general, it's not a tremendous direct impact right here on most things like borrowing rates. It does, perhaps in general, it has set the financial markets on edge. The stock market has been kind of stalled out for a little while. But in general, it's not all that much of a real-world impact today.
Ryan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And good luck to you.
Thanks.
And let's get one more question in on this economic situation. Nick in Princeton, New Jersey.
Yes, hi. I was wondering how much of the improvement in the growth in the economy is potentially due to the war itself, and ultimately how would the Fed deal with something like that as the situation changes in Iraq?
Defense spending, I guess, what Nick is talking about. Bill Cheney?
Well, historically, I guess it's certainly true that wars tend to be good for the economy. Sounds kind of callous, but unfortunately true. Of government spending, for whatever reason, productive, unproductive, or anything else, does indeed tend to boost the economy. I don't believe that in this situation it's been a huge part of the story, but it certainly is true that the Fed is not the only policy actor in this situation. Fiscal policy, the running up of a huge budget deficit in a short period of time, has indeed proved to be a big, big boost in this period of economic weakness. Looking ahead, the problem is that the economy doesn't need any further boost, but we appear to be still in line for record budget deficits, especially if expiring tax cuts get extended into the future. So there are definitely some issues to worry about here. Obviously, I have no ability to forecast what the defense budget is going to be in the years ahead, but it does look as if there is some danger on that front of overheating the economy, and that would cause the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates even higher to offset it.
Nick, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And I wanted to thank our guests for their time today, especially at such a dramatic moment. Bill Cheney, Chief Economist for MFC Global Investment Management. He joined us from Boston. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Mike Santoli, nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Mike Santoli, Senior Editor at Barron's Magazine. He joined us on the phone from his office in New York. Now let's switch subjects a little bit and talk about one of the leading economic indicators. From time to time, you hear National Public Radio and other news organizations report on the Consumer Confidence Index, a measurement prepared by the Conference Board, which is an independent, not-for-profit membership organization based in New York City. The index comes out on the last Tuesday of every month at 10 a.m. Here's Lynn Franco, head of the group that determines each month's index, talking about the level of consumer confidence 3.5 years ago.
Consumers are becoming increasingly apprehensive about the outlook for business conditions, the labor market, and their income prospects. And, you know, they're telling us that this kind of fear of a recession has increased over the last several months.
Well, joining us now from her office in New York is Lynn Franco, one of the Conference Board's Consumer Research Center, who we just heard. And it's very nice of you to be with us today.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
So, obviously, things have changed.
Yes, they have. They've improved dramatically over the past several years, and especially in the last month.
And what accounts for the rise?
Labor market. We've seen some good growth over the last several months, and that's really key to boosting confidence levels.
How do you measure consumer confidence?
We ask consumers five very basic questions. We ask them to appraise the present situation regarding business conditions and employment. And then we ask them their expectations 6 months out regarding business conditions, employment, and income. And those five questions make up consumer confidence.
And these are how many people do you question?
We question 5,000 people, and typically 3,500 respond in a month.
And these are, I assume, all over the country?
Yes, it's nationally representative.
And again, give us some idea of what those questions are.
We ask them to appraise current business conditions and current employment conditions, and then we ask them their expectations regarding business conditions, employment, and income. So it's kind of a mix of current conditions and expectations.
Is this what they expect in the economy as a whole, or whether they plan to buy a refrigerator?
Well, we do ask some buying questions. Those don't go into the actual index, but we ask them, you know, do they intend to purchase an auto, a home, and then some big-ticket items as well.
But this sounds, it's a bit of a psychological index then, isn't it?
There is somewhat of a psychological aspect, too, but we've seen over time that it's a pretty good measure of the health of the economy.
It's interesting, with the big jump that you reported in the Consumer Confidence Index yesterday, that came at the same time that some of the biggest retailers in the country, Walmart, Target, were reporting that, their sales were a little bit down. How does that track?
Exactly. Well, what we're seeing here is what consumers are telling us is that the buying climate for them is favorable. However, you know, as far as the retailers were concerned, some of the reason for the lackluster sales was that the Mother Nature did not cooperate. And due to the cool weather, a lot of the summer stock was not moved off the shelves.
So people weren't buying fans and air conditioners.
Exactly. It was a little too chilly for that.
Okay. We're talking with Lynn Franco, director of the Conference Board's Consumer Research Center, about the index that she releases every month. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get some questions on the line for Lynn Franco. Brian joins us now from Florence, South Carolina.
Yes, ma'am. I'm just concerned. I'm wondering, you were talking about the numbers that you got and 5,000 people based on the millions of people in America. And what kind of people are they? Self-employed or are they independent? And where is an independent contractor like myself, which business, in my opinion, has dropped over the last 8 months? And where will we get these numbers from? And how do you say 5,000 people? And what kind of income do they have or related to just normal average people? Would you say that it would relate to us and say, because I don't think the economy's doing any better?
It does. We try and get people from, you know, all age groups, all income groups. And what we do in our survey, too, is we break it down on a regional basis. And not all regions of the country are as well off. We do have some, you know, some regions where growth is a little bit slower, and that may be the case here.
Is Brian right that South Carolina might be one of those slower growing areas?
Exactly.
Some others, well, we knew that, of course, the Pacific Northwest had terrible employment problems during the recession and was very slow to recover. Are they having problems?
The Pacific Northwest now has actually made quite a recovery. We're seeing some problems still where we're kind of behind the national level. In the Middle Atlantic, which includes New York and the East North Central states, which, you know, how we're hard hit from the manufacturing job losses.
Mm-hmm. Brian, well, good luck to you.
Okay, well, the only thing I wanted to know is this an average of over 50% of the economy or over 50% of the nation that you're saying? Is it just specific areas are doing that well?
There are certain areas, obviously, that are doing better than others, and we try to capture, you know, the entire nation. There are some areas that are going to have a much more impact because they have a much larger population.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
That's why,
you know what I need to go to get these numbers at and kind of keep a
track
running tab on this thing?
You can just log on to our website at 10 a.m. on the last Tuesday of the month, and the figures are up there.
And that,
okay.
Thanks.
I sure appreciate it.
Good luck, Brian.
All right.
And let's talk to Phil. And Phil joins us on the line from San Francisco.
Hi.
Phil, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. I was wondering if the index actually is broken down into regions. In the San Francisco Bay Area, I feel that our economy isn't doing very well. And a lot of the basic things like the cost of housing is just soared out of reach for the average person. The cost of gasoline has always been over $2. I just don't feel this wonderful uptick in consumer confidence.
Well, the Pacific region actually has done better over the course of the past year, and that would include the San Francisco area as well. However, we're nowhere near the levels that we saw back in 2000. So while we have made some progress, there's obviously room for more.
Now, the Consumer Confidence Index, as it was released yesterday, as I understand, is 109?
It was at 101.9.
Yes.
And to put it in perspective, back in 2000, we hit 144. So
a lot of room still to make up that gap.
Exactly.
Okay. And Phil, thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
And briefly, why is consumer confidence such an important economic statistic?
Well, consumer spending accounts for about two-thirds of all economic activity, so consumers are definitely a key ingredient in the economic pie.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Lynn Franco joining us on the phone from the Conference Board's Consumer Research Center, and that's in New York City. When we come back from a short break, we're going to switch focus and talk about the Pentagon's decision to call up ready reservists for duty. More than 5,000 former soldiers are being called back to duty. The issues involve, of course, the overstretch of American forces as they're sent to Iraq, continue to serve in Afghanistan and many other parts of the world. This is also part of a policy to make use of what soldiers the Pentagon already has as Congress continues to discuss ideas for increasing the number of the all-volunteer armed forces. And the other issue, of course, that many soldiers in uniform come up against is so-called stop loss. Units that are going to Afghanistan or to Iraq find themselves, men and women in those units, find themselves unable to leave even if they were scheduled to do so. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, email TOTN at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News.